Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Good morning and welcome to the New Books in History podcast, part of the New Books Network. My name is Christoph Wodinitz. I'm your host. And today we are talking with David Tavares, a historian of Latin America, a linguistic anthropologist, and a Mesoamericanist. He was born in Ciudad Juarez, and he teaches at Vassar. His courses and research focus on religion, calendars, ritual practice, colonial Nahuatl and Zapotec texts, campaigns against idolatry, indigenous intellectuals, and native Christianities. He's the author of The Invisible War and more than 45 peer-reviewed articles and chapters. He is also editor of Words and Worlds Turned Around, the book we are talking about today, and co-author of Painted Words and Chimalpain's Conquest. So welcome, Dr. Tavares, and thank you for joining us today.
It is my pleasure, Christoph.
So this book comes from a 2015 conference. Would you please tell us how you first envisioned the panel and who your collaborators were and how this turned into this book project?
Yeah, you're right. This comes from a 2015 conference of the American Society for Ethnohistory. And this, I think, initially was to rethink indigenous Christianities with a group of people who have been influenced in some ways by recent work on Christianities and translations of texts into indigenous languages. And I guess chiefly among them is the work, of course, of Louis Burkhardt. But then, of course, we have new philologists who are trained by James Lockhart, who have shared the different perspective on lots of different texts. So the central concern, I think, was to make historians and the historians and anthropologists aware of very recent work that has taken place in terms of not just thinking about missionary lexicography and conversion in terms of power relations and political relations or in terms of control over texts and meanings, but to really shine a light on lots of different attempts to translate similar concepts coming from Christianity. So what we try to do is to put together a very large group of languages. We have 8 languages represented in the book, Valley Zapotec, Northern Zapotec, Nahuatl, Quechua, Yucatec Maya, Quiche Maya, Quechi Maya, and Tupi. So this is, I think, a bit extraordinary in terms of the range of different sources. Most of the sources are focused on the 16th and the 17th century. And of course, we have an epilogue that was written by a Nahuatl anthropologist from the Huasteca region, Abelardo de la Cruz, who talks about Nahuatl Christianities today. We felt that there wasn't quite something like this before that embraced such a range of languages that really try to look very closely at methodologies of translation, at indigenous intellectuals, at the role that they played in specific terms, and also at the conversation and exchanges between indigenous intellectuals and missionary authors and lexicographers.
That is a tremendous project, and not only very ambitious, but very successful. Would you tell our listeners in broad strokes about the world you are accessing through your research? Maybe start with Columbus and Cortez and tell us, what was this conquest? How many conquistadors came? How many Spaniards lived among the indigenous peoples of Mexico and Mesoamerica? Maybe briefly tell us, who were these friars? What were they trying to do? How long was this conversion effort? And maybe also tell us a little bit about the native religions, if you can. I know that's a tremendous request.
Okay. Where should I start with? I guess with the mission invasion, because that's a huge question.
Yes, please.
I'll start with that. I guess, I mean, one way to think about this is that everyone goes back to the work of Robert Ricard, La Conquête Spirituelle de Mexique, The Spiritual Conquest of Mexico, which, of course, came out in the late 1930s, and it was translated in the early 60s into English. And it made a big impact in the sense that it presented, some of the words that you use could be coming directly from Ricard, in the sense that we think about this as this massive project that involves missionaries and conquerors. And of course, Ricard's major contribution was to look at all the different things that, in particular, Franciscans did in central Mexico, while also alluding to other orders and other areas. But this is at the core, I think, of what people think about when they think about conversion. So, of course, just to, go back to the very initial question you posed, Cortés comes into, Cozumel y las Mujeres in 1519, starts destroying temples to his heart's content, and continues to do so, and place crosses as long as indigenous people let him, and indigenous allies sometimes they do, sometimes they don't, right? At this point, he might have had access to sacred texts, sacred Maya texts that might eventually turn up in Europe later on. I guess as he goes into central Mexico, and this is, I think, a key question that has been examined in particularly between 2019 and 2020, because, of course, this is the 500th anniversary of that first arrival. So we tend to think about this as an encounter, but in some ways, what really matters is what happens afterwards, because, and again, I mentioned the new philologists earlier. One way to think about what conquerors did was that they came in, they, of course, secure the allegiance of indigenous states through either military conquest, which was the case, with the Mexican Empire, or through military alliances, which was the case with almost everyone else. And then after that, I think what happens in terms of relating to religions is that there are different ways to approach this. And in my own work, I've talked about different cycles, right, not only dialogue, but also punitive measures. And of course, the first one belongs to what is called the Apostolic Inquisition, which begins quite early. You have inquisitors like Betanzos in the what is now the Dominican Republic and Hispaniola issuing decrees and trying to investigate. But when it comes to Mexico, it really comes in through the work of people who are related to the first Franciscans who came in as a group. And again, I'll take a step back from that kind of momentous arrival that you alluded at the beginning. And we have to think that, there were three Franciscans that came in right after Cortés completed his military domination of the Mexican Empire. These were Pedro de Gante, Tecto, and Ahora. And I'm using, of course, the Spanish versions of people who were actually Flemish Franciscans. So these first three Franciscans begin to settle in central Mexico. And just as they're beginning to try to get a grasp on language and conversion, the so-called 12 Franciscans, which are, of course, not the first 12 because these three Franciscans arrived earlier, come in 1524 and then make their way on foot from the port of Veracruz to Mexico City, thus kind of rehashing the entry of Cortés. And of course, and this goes back to Ricard's point, this is not a military conquest, but a spiritual one. So we have this 12.
May I ask? So Cortés originally had a few hundred soldiers, right? And yet he was able to secure all of these allies who were really tired of Mexica rule, perhaps Tlaxcala come to mind. How many Spanish are here? And how you were talking about military alliances. Who's in charge? How many people are there? And do they have to negotiate every step of the way so that they don't get murdered? Or do they really have an iron grip as they're trying to not only control, but understand who these people are in the first place?
Let me try to address this. And I guess to go back to historiography, I should mention that in some ways, this idea of few men conquering thousands of people comes... first of all, from Cortés's early letters. So it's a political propaganda, so to speak, that is generated by Cortés as soon as he realizes what is going on and that his alliances are successful. So this is something that, of course, Cortés first claims, and then López de Gómara begins to put together into a wonderfully well-written literary account of the conquest of Mexico, right? That he writes on behalf of Cortés. And that comes out in the early 1550s, goes through a number of different editions. And of course, this is kind of what I like to call the providential a version of the conquest history. Just a handful of men, maybe a couple hundred, small number of horses that are joined by maybe a couple hundred more that come from Narváez. And if you remember, Pánfilo Narváez is the man who sent from Cuba to rein in Cortés by the governor of Cuba, who's not happy about Cortés kind of breaking out free and claiming this new land without having the legal and political requirements that would entitle him to actually go forward and take these lands in the name of the King of Spain. So even, with the, 400-ish men, the contrast is always drawn. And this begins, again, from, 1552, from López de Gómara onwards, in terms of, like, building this provincial history, right? And for English speakers, I think William Prescott, who writes The Conquest of Mexico, in the early 1840s, and of course, this is one of the volumes that the U.S. soldiers who invade Mexico in the War of Intervention carry with them to understand the country they're invading. And this version by Prescott, which is also very well written in English, and it's also followed by an account on the conquest of Peru, is predicated on this notion that very few men come in and conquer hundreds of thousands of people. Now, for the most part, I think a lot of historians in Latin America never took that very seriously. This, I think, comes from, in some ways, a strand that for instance, Ricard is much more concerned with the monumental work the Franciscans did, which to him is probably counts as much more impressive than what Cortés ever did. So a lot of people, I think, who have read Prescott and have influenced, been influenced by him, and I think this would count definitely people who are, writing the history of conquest today in English, have this way of approaching this as the, as I mentioned, for this kind of providential question. And of course, for people who are familiar with the dynamics of the conquest, you would note that the first thing that Cortés tries to do is to establish alliances with Maya-speaking peoples in Yucatan and then the Gulf Coast. Those first encounters give him a translator that he's able then to link to Malintzin or Malinche, who translates between different Maya languages and Nahuatl. So what you have then is an early attempt by Cortés to try to find allies, and he finds them in different places, most prominently in terms of even López de Gómez's account, the people of Tlaxcala, who are very angry with the Mexica. But by the time that, you know, remember, there's a kind of an flow. Cortés comes in on, what, November 8, 1519, is received by Moctezuma. He takes Moctezuma prisoner. He is then ejected from the city in the early spring of the next year after executing Moctezuma. And then a resistance from within the Mexican Empire begins, right? But then this is the point at which Cortés goes back on his previous talks with lots of different Nahua speaking, primarily, but also people who spoke other languages who are not happy with the Mexica rule. And he comes back and then lays siege to Mexico Tenochtitlan, the capital of the Mexican Empire. And this is something that takes place in 1521, roughly speaking, from kind of late spring until August 13 of 1521, which is the day that Mexico Tenochtitlan falls, right? But the Mexico Tenochtitlan doesn't fall to 400 men. It falls to a Spanish men who are leading armies of tens of thousands of indigenous allies who are very happy to come in and sack the city of their former overlords and pillage and, you know, take, you know, what they can. And of course, this is a process that, as far as we know, is orchestrated by Cortés himself. But, you know, something important to emphasize here, just in terms of numbers, since you brought this up a couple of times, is that the reason why, you know, Mexico Tenochtitlan falls is because there's a concerted effort on the part of tens of thousands of allies that are led by the respective leaders who decide to rebel basically against the Mexican Empire, and they accept Cortés's leadership in that regard. But at the same time, they make even the very brave resistance that came out from a different generation of leaders after Moctezuma, particularly Cuauhtémoc, irrelevant in military terms, because there's just so many of them attacking so few of the Mexica former overlords.
I think that really helps us imagine it, and especially for a United States audience where there is a imagine a tradition where the English arrive in the New World and continually displace the native peoples, and you end up with this English society or Dutch and, you know, French and whatever. But I think it's more interesting to think of Mexico as a new arrival group of Spaniards and Spanish Catholics who then somehow have to use the existing power structures there in order to manage such an empire. And so I think that helps us think about what this Christianization would look like and who is doing the work. And maybe that's where you can tell us the next chapter, which is really the subject of your book.
Yeah. So, yeah, no, that I'm kind of responding to your big two or three major questions that you asked me a while ago,
yes,
step by step. So now we can talk about the missionization. So again, going back to the early days after the conquest, something that the Franciscans in particular knew had to happen was that they had to communicate with indigenous people, not using Spanish or Latin, because they knew neither of those languages, but they had to actually begin acquiring those languages, right? So the early Franciscans, just to go back to, you know, the work that begins to be done in the first decade, the 1520s after conquest, again, to emphasize this point, the Spanish are ruling over indigenous states that are still headed by indigenous nobility, and that, you know, life continues to go on for maybe a generation or generation and a half in much the way that it had gone on before the conquest. And then gradually we come to a And this is, of course, something that is important for the Franciscans, because on the one hand, they want to establish dominance on the language. This begins with Gante establishing a school at San José los Naturales, which is meant for young indigenous people to be trained in not only Christianity, but also European arts and practices. Then we have, of course, Martin de Valencia, who's a leader of the 12, who is constantly pushing forward and is actually getting quite impatient. You know, at some point, he even has dreams about going to Asia because the people, and this, you know, happens, according to Mendieta and other chroniclers, by the late 1520s. He just gets tired of indigenous people not accepting that Christianity is the one true religion, and he starts dreaming about going to Asia and you know, encountering other people who are going to be more pliant in some ways, right? And at the same time, he pairs up with Zumárraga, who's going to become the first elected bishop of Mexico around 1528. Then he is appointed. He comes back in the early 1530s, and he starts the first formal inquisitorial process for inquisitional tribunal, not only for indigenous people, but for anybody who was the subject of the Inquisition, which was, of course, everyone in early modern Spanish society, in the mid-1530s. So he, Valencia and Zumárraga pair up to destroy idols. Valencia famously executes some indigenous elites in Tlaxcala and other places that he sees as, you know, going against the faith. At the same time, Gante and other believe that, you know, going back to this generational issue that I talked about, the current elites are corrupted. They're not going to Christianity willingly. So I have to work on the next generation. So we have a lot of the work that, you know, it is about indoctrination, about teaching indigenous people how to be European Christians, but also to a very small group of them, how to be European scholars. So the idea, of course, is to isolate young people who are coming from elite backgrounds. This begins to be done by Gante, but really is taken to the next step with the Colegio de Santa Cruz, which is established in Tlatelolco, a city-state just north of Mexico-Tenochtitlan, in 1536. And of course, this is a school that needs the support of Bishop Zumárraga, the support of civil authorities, and it does so. And when it opens in 1536, it opens its doors to dozens of colegiales, to mostly Nahua speakers, but they would probably have been people who spoke Otomi or other languages that are spoken, Ñaño or Otomi, in central Mexico. And these people are exposed to the liberal arts, the trivium and the quadrivium, which means they get the same kind of curriculum that scholars who might be going for their first degree in Europe are being exposed to, right? And they then become the partners of primarily Franciscans at Santa Cruz, of course, in terms of not only teaching them Nahuatl and other languages, but also helping them translate everything that the Franciscans wants them. I want them to translate into Nahuatl. And here is, I mean, and just to kind of give you a sketch of a couple of other important people, I'm going to talk about the Franciscans first, and then you can, I'll stop and see if you have questions, and then I'll continue with the Dominicans, who are also very important. I haven't really talked about yet. Just to go back to the early context, you have, of course, the 12, and that includes people like Jacob de Testera, who's a French Franciscan, whose name is primarily associated with pictorial catechisms. And if we just make a slight correction, I think that's correct, because he is one of the people who is associated with because he doesn't know Nahuatl. In the 1520s, he starts preaching through pictures. So that means unfurling large lienzos, large representations of the crucifixion, of the birth of Jesus, of these important episodes in the life of Christ, and showing through pictures with a translator, with whatever means are at Testera's disposal, how, you know, and why, and to become Christians, and what Christianity is. Eventually what happens is that you have the production of the first catechisms and grammars. But this idea, of course, that the pictorial catechisms that we have, which come mostly, it seems, from the 17th century, are directly linked to Testera, seems to be an incorrect idea. And it seems like while there are, you know, there are some catechisms, like the so-called Humboldt catechism, that it's very different to the other pictographic catechisms, and that works with images in a very different way. They might be related to this first phase, and all the other pictographic catechisms are actually produced in the 17th century, which is kind of interesting, because this is indigenous people no longer need them. They read and write using the Spanish the Roman alphabet. And they are, of course, remaking these catechisms to kind of reclaim this indigenous identity that it was born through early evangelization. But to go back to Testera and to what is going on there with the early Franciscans, is that of course the first important task is to produce a doctrine in indigenous language. So one attempt, of course, that takes shape and bears its fruit around 1546, 1547, is Gante's first catechism. And we have later versions of it that survive in full, not so much about the earliest version. But Gante's catechism is one of the first systematic attempts to take together all the teachings of Christianity and put them in Nahuatl. Something important to think about is that as Gante is doing this, he's also thinking about promoting what he's doing. So there are some interesting letters that he sends to his province, the province of the Flemish Franciscans in the 1530s, just advertising what he's doing, talking about what he does with the young converts. One of these letters, and this is something that I talk about in the preface of the book, ends with the first a phrase that is actually printed in Nahuatl, because this is a letter that is then edited in Flemish produced edition of different letters that are coming from different parts of the world. And this is, to go back to what is animating the Franciscans, this is in some ways precipitated by this belief that comes from Joachim di Fiore and other early Franciscans, that we are in the 1520s, 1530s, living in the age of the Holy Spirit that had been preceded by the age of the Father, which is the Old Testament, age of the Son, which begins with Jesus. So now, during this age, there's going to be a lot of marvels that happen. You know, the gospel is preached to all four corners of earth. And of course, Gante's a letter and the early catechisms fit in with this narrative, because this explains, you know, why the Franciscans are having so much success according to them, right? We have, just to go back to Gante's work, we have that early catechism, which is followed very, very, very quickly by the Dominican doctrine of 1548, reprinted in 1550, which is the opposite of Gante. The Dominicans come in, they have been studying now as well. They don't have as much control of Central Mexico at that point as they would like to have, because they've been excluded by the Franciscans, and yet they produce this again, very solid a first doctrina in 1548, which they actually present as an anonymous work, because they want to very studiously kind of avoid this tendency of Gante and Testera and other, Valencia and other Franciscans, to kind of take individual credit or credit for the order for the work that they're doing. So in practice, actually, if you look at, you know, how they translate different Christian concepts, there's an early, and this is something that, you know, is talked about in some of the essays, of course, you know, is picked up in Justina Olko's essay, is picked up in the introduction by Louis Burkhardt, that there's an early lexicon to translate different terms into Nahuatl. And you see this lexicon kind of come together with Gante, also with the Dominican Doctrine 1548. And from that point on, I think most people tend to agree on a lot of, you know, translation choices that are made by these early Franciscans and early Dominicans. We don't know much about the context, but this goes on until the end of 16th century. I'm sorry.
Well, I think this, I was going to say, before we lose that thread, it's such an enormous question, is who is it, you know, who is it for? And I think of that sentence that you have in your conclusion, where Pedro Legante is writing his first Nahuatl line. Mm-hmm. And you said you noticed, like, well, he did it correctly, but he also garbled it here and there. But he's writing it for his, you know, his publisher back in Flanders. Mm-hmm. And Pedro de Gante, or Peter of Ghent, I can't remember at the moment. Maybe you can correct me. He is somehow connected to the Emperor Charles, who's also from the Low Countries, or at least raised there. And so he has this patronage back in Europe, and everybody's trying to show, look at these achievements, look how we spread the gospel to the far corners of the world. And the rationale for the empire, at least from the Pope, is like, look, you're going to convert these people to the true faith. And so a lot of this is demonstrating their achievements. And I think even those letters of Cortez that you mentioned, where he is inventing numbers for dramatic effect, he's trying to demonstrate to his emperor, look how providential is this conquest of these people. And so much of this that we read in your book is, look what we've achieved. But the thing that you do that's so interesting is try to figure out what the people on the ground are thinking about this. And you do this through careful philology and looking at terms and images. This is what it says to the European outsider, but perhaps this is what is the Zapotec meaning or Mexica meaning or Maya. What is that interplay between who's watching, who is it for? And then, of course, I think the another question, which maybe we can get to later, is, you know, what is the nature of this conversion? Because it's not that simple.
Okay. Well, the nature, of course, is what occupied Ricard for the most part, and people have debated in different ways. So I guess I'll come to that at the end. First, I think I'm going to address your very important question about, like, who is this for, and what kind of, how can we even begin to think about indigenous reception, right? So, you know, as we go along, I think I'm in some ways we're kind of debunking, I won't call them myths, but received ideas, right, about conversion. Like, people seem to think that, the Pope does this, the Franciscans come in, which is certainly how it is presented to indigenous people. This is how it appears in a catechism that is attributed to Pedro Moctezuma, which I talked about in Painted Words. But it's definitely kind of this version, again, of providential history, right, that we're trying to move away from. In some ways, Ricard contributes to that by presenting this a struggle, particularly Franciscans, as this monumental struggle where the Franciscans seem to hold a lot of the power to convince, the power to convert. But when you begin to look at different things, and I think, you know, rather than, you know, speaking extempore, I want to go back and tie it to some of the chapters in the book. So if you think in very specific terms about this dialogue, the chapters 2 and 3 look at how a notion that was seen by the Franciscans in central Mexico and by Jesuits and other clerics in Peru in the 16th century as a notion of confession is really more tied to particular ways of admitting one's transgressions before a native priest and acknowledging this notion of it is not, again, sin, but rather something like in the Nahua case, a neologism is used, tlatlacoli, something damaged, is not something that is used in quite those terms. But there's notions about guilt, that of things that are mostly transgressions I have committed, being committed wittingly or unwittingly by someone, that have to come out into the open with the help of a native indigenous specialist. And something similar happens with the notion of hucha.
In that chapter, I think you say that the guilt and the evil is a Zapotec idea, and the Nahuatl idea is something, like you said, damaged or off balance. But that feels to me much more like the original Greek idea of sin as something having missed the mark, you know, whereas this Zapotec seems more to me rooted in this indigenous idea of a twisted branch, if I'm
Mm-hmm.
I have that right?
Oh, yeah. No, I was talking about the Nahua chapter and the Quechua chapter, which are chapters 2 and 3. But now I'll go back to the Zapotec case. Going back again, you know, we have this notion of something damaged that is clearly neologism in Nahuatl versus hucha, which has to do with something like guilt, something unbalanced. And then if we look at what happens in the Zapotec case, we also have a particular ritual where people who are performing penance come and have to lie before a priest a set of a pieces of a dried plant that is twisted, and each strand represents a particular transgression or guilt, right? And this is exactly, you know, Tola in Zapotec refers to that particular assembly of dried vegetal matter that is presented to the priest. And in some ways, this is actually a parse for the whole metaphor in terms of how Dominicans then think about the notion of sin. They think that, and again, we have to take a step back and figure out why they're thinking about this. They have a sense that indigenous people might have come to comparable notions that exist in Christianity, either through error, human error, or through the devil's actions, right? And in some ways, you know, if we think about the work of Aquinas, we might favor kind of a more, in some ways, different way of how that originates, having to do mostly perhaps with human transgressions. But it depends on, you know, what the particular person is, the particular missionary is thinking. But the effect is that the Dominicans, and in this case, we're talking in particular about Pedro de Feria, who writes the first doctrinal work in Zapotec in 1567. And we're talking about Juan de Córdoba, who writes the first dictionary in Zapotec and also a grammar of Zapotec that are both published in 1578. They identify notions like the notion of course, the deity, which they use Betao, which is the Zapotec word for a deity or supernatural. They decide to recruit the name of the Lord of the Underworld, which is Bezalao, as a name for the devil, which is something that Franciscans do in the Yucatec context as well. They recruit that notion of Tola as sin, and then they deploy it as you know, the translation of sin. But then to go back to the I was trying to
the first. Could you comment a little more on that, where you take the existing Lord of the Underworld and overlay his name on the Christian concept of the devil? Is that something to, do you think, demonize the current polytheistic structure, or to make, you know, give a name to something? And do they not realize they're, you know, that they're failing to erase the old, which was what they were supposed to be doing? Isn't that I found that so remarkable, that you would borrow an existing, you know, like we could say Hades. I think people say that in from time to time. And I, that just struck me as such a surprise.
Yeah, well, you have problems if you think about it, right? If you just like borrow the name of a supernatural. And this is what happens in the Zapotec case, right? Beselao is always, you know, from Feria on, from 1567 onwards, how you think about the devil. The problem is, of course, at the same time, and this comes for mostly from my work on divination practices and a corpus of 102 manuals, calendrical manuals that were produced in the second half of the 17th century in northern Zapotec communities. For them, actually, Beselao is a deity that they continue to worship. They continue to give offerings to differing deities that include a creator deity, Gobechi, a deity of fishes and rivers, a female deity, Wuchana, and Beselao, which is still the lord of the underworld. So you do have a problem in the sense that for the Zapotecs, I mean, they don't have any kind of cognitive problem in terms of doing that. There are as far as I understand, the people who are still worshiping Beselao in the 17th century are quite happy to do so using the name of this deity, using rituals that go back to the post-classic, the period right before the Spanish conquest, right? At the same time, when they go to church, they, you know, use Beselao for the name of the devil. When they confess to the crime of idolatry, they talk about Chinake Beselao, which means the labor for the lord of the underworld, right? Because they know that this is precisely kind of discourse that the Dominicans have taught them and that is expected of them, right? And this doesn't really get them into trouble until there is, you know, first a rebellion in 1660 that has to do more with economic concerns with repartimientos, which are this really unequal purchasing contracts that are laid on indigenous communities with taxation. And then there's another rebellion in 1700 in northern Oaxaca, right, against Dominicans who catch a number of indigenous people performing a ceremony that actually, you know, I just found out just recently in my work, consists of turning the actual images of Christians against the wall and renouncing them as you actually ritually slaughter a deer whose blood is going to be used to feed some deities, right? So we have
that's amazing. Is it so that the images are not watching them do this, or is it so that they do not dishonor the sacrifice of the blood by having foreign gods present? What do you think that means, turning the pictures away? I'm saying in what year this was.
I'm focusing on this particular detail because people have talked a lot about what happened on September 14, 1700, when two people who are, you know, friends with the Franciscans in this community of San Francisco Cajonos bring two Dominicans who are resident in the community to the house of somebody called Jose Flores, who is the head of the Confraternity of the Rosary. So he has a Christian persona in public, but he's also leading a particular ritual. And this is something that, you know, has puzzled me for a while, because the Spanish, of course, one of the first things that they report is like, well, they're basically half caught up in the deer. The deer is inside and it's basically being cut open, and people are taking away the meat and the blood. And they clearly see that there's this representations of saints facing away, facing the wall. And I just found a reference to something called the renunciation of Loa, of images, in a particular calendar that comes from that region, which means that perhaps on certain days, they renounce the images by turning them against the wall, just exactly as is captured by different descriptions of that scene that took place on September 14, 1700. So just to go back again, I kind of introduced a lot of different details in terms of how difficult the process actually was on the ground, right? So we have all this we have a discourse of, you know, becoming Christian, but also continuing your practices and talking back to Christianity, right? And just to go back and finish kind of the Zapata case and then offer something that is kind of the polar opposite of that in the Nahua world. We have, of course, this idea, which I think is a Ricardian idea, that the Dominicans come in and they're great at rhetoric. They're great at taking different concepts from Zapotecs. And for instance, I mentioned the Confraternity of the Rosary. There is a monumental work called Spiritual Miscellany Espiritual, that is printed by Cristóbal de Agüero in 1666. And this is a massive work that has all these different works in Zapotec, in Valley Zapotec, that are meant to be used by, you know, people who are devotees of the Rosary, of Marian devotions, to tell them how to pray, right? In this really, what is the right word? Literary Zapotec, this beautiful Zapotec. And what he does is he tries to convince them that this actually the word from Zachila, which is actually, you know, the theme that gives a name to the chapter in my work. This idea that they're going to embrace something called the Zachila word, Ticha Zachila, which is basically ties the notion of a word that comes from Zachila. And Zachila is, of course, a very important polity before the conquest. Basically, in the 15th and 16th centuries, one of the most important Valley Zapotec states. This is where a lot of rulers are buried. So there is this notion of Zachila in the Zapotec thought as this important political capital. So what are you trying to do?
May I ask about the Zachila? So this is the second half of the 17th century, and they're remembering the name of the polity that preceded the arrival of the Spaniards. So they're going back 200 years in memory, or almost. As, for them, is that like, this is the name of our people? So this is, you know, this gospel is the word of our people? Or is it expressly, this is the precursor state before the foreigners came? Don't forget who you are.
I think it's a bit more towards the second possibility that you mentioned. Let's also be clear about something else. Agüero is a vicar of Zachila, so he has kind of a personal interest in making Zachila shine. But I found references to Zachila.
What is that? What is a vicar? What is a vicar of Zachila? What is his role there? Because he's also a Dominican friar at the same time, isn't he?
Yeah, okay, well, we were talking earlier about how the Franciscans basically took over central Mexico, right? So the Dominicans see what happened, and in the 1530s, they start looking for other communities to evangelize and also to set up shop with no other, let's say, competition, right? So they go to Oaxaca, they go to Chiapas. By the mid-17th century, they have basically been in charge of evangelization in Oaxaca since the late 1530s, early 1540s. They have a lot of wealth. They're very dominant. So Burgoa, of course, it talks about this. Francisco Burgoa chronicles all the different things that the Dominican order did and talks, you know, about Agüero's work, for instance. But to go back to Agüero, Agüero is somebody who has deep knowledge of the Zapotec language, spent decades working, talking to Zapotecs, teaching them, you know, the prayers in Zapotec, is a prominent member of the Dominican order. The vicar, that means that he is the person in charge of administering the sacraments to people in Zachila. There's other people who are working under his command, of course, but he's one of the main Dominicans in Zachila. So just to go back to the question of Zachila and why this is so important for Zapotecs, I've seen that name come up in other songs from northern Oaxaca. So because that comes up in other texts. I know that it's not just Agüero saying Zachila is the best because this is where I live, right? It's more about going back to that earlier notion of Zaćila as the most important state in the 15th century, right? Because, I mean, to cut a very long story short, there's somebody called Don Juan Cortes Cosillopi, who is a ruler of Tehuantepec, who is actually caught worshipping in Mitla. And by the 15th century, Zapotec polities exist in the Valley of Oaxaca, but there's a very strong connection between rulers in Zaćila, rulers in Tehuantepec, and then the other node, of course, is Mitla, which is a Spanish version of Mictlan, the town of the dead. That's Nahuatl, the actual name of that sanctuary in Zapotec's Lioba. So people continue to go to Lioba because important lords are buried there, as they are buried in Zaćila and as they were buried in Monte Albán in the classic period. But that would take us back to 200 to 500 of the common era, right? So you have these sanctuaries and you have these ruling groups and elites attached to particular states. So to go back to, you know, what it means to talk about Zaćila in 1666, for Agüero, talking about the one of the most revered ideas of a political authority for the Zapotecs, and tying it to the memory of Zaćila. And of course, as I said quite a while ago, unfortunately, the word of Zaćila is actually a term that he uses to talk about Christianity. So he's trying, I mean, if you see it from not just a perspective that Agüero wanted to impose, but trying to step outside and think about what a literate Zapotec might think about this. He's trying to appeal to Zapotec pride in their own history. He's trying to say, well, the war that you asked before is a war that is, I'm not going to try to quote it directly, but it's a war that is basically covered in dirt. It's a war that is robed, that is hidden. This is a direct reference to precisely the kind of rituals that I was talking about back on remembering the slaughter deer on 1700. All these rituals that specialists conduct are couched in a language that is not very transparent to people. This actually exists, of course, in throughout Mesoamerica. And what Agüero is trying to do is indict that language for being so opaque and contrasting it with the war of Zaćila, which is actually the war of Christianity, which is a pure war, a new war, a war that is easily understood. And that's the basis of his argument. You have to accept this new Christian war because it's tied somehow to the war of Zapotec state. It's better than the war of your ritual specialist, right? And of course, what is going to happen is that some people are going to take that path and decide, well, you know, I'm convinced by the argument of Agüero, I'm convinced by the argument of Franciscans about rejecting my previous beliefs. Other people like Northern Zapotecs are going to say, well, you know, we're going to exist in these worlds with one foot firmly planted in the Christian world, the other on the world of the ancestors. And they managed to do that in public, at least until the early 18th century. And after that, that seems to go down a kind of an underground, right? Because these practices don't come up and are not as punished as often as they were in the 17th century in Oaxaca. So do we have time now to turn to the polar opposite of that, which is...
Yes, I would love to hear this.
Okay. So to think about, and this, you know, I'm kind of now jumping centuries. You know, we've gone and kind of seen some elements of the Dominican trajectory. The last thing that I said about the Franciscans was that they had established this school in Tlatelolco in 1536. I haven't really told you about what they do. People attached with this school work with Bernardino de Sahagún to produce one of the most monumental works about Nahua culture and society, the Historia General or Florentine Codex. They work with Alonso de Molina, composes the first dictionary, Nahuatl to Spanish, in 1555, expands it in 1571. And they work with lots of other people, among them Juan Bautista Viseo, who in the late 16th, early 17th century produces more of the dozen works in Nahuatl. They work with lots of other authors. Another important author that I should mention is Juan de Gaona, who produces the so-called Conversations about Christian Doctrine in the 1540s, which is a work that because of concerns with what the Franciscans are doing, because you have to also think that what is happening in the school of Santa Cruz doesn't go without a response on the part of ecclesiastic observers or colonial authorities who feel that indigenous people should not have access to a liberal education, to Latin, to the printing press, because there's actually a printing press in Santa Cruz, to knowing how to translate from Latin into Nahuatl or into Spanish. So you have this generation of people who are perhaps, if you were to choose somebody who represents all of them, most people think about Antonio Valeriano, who was a governor of Mexico Tenochtitlan, and who was very prominent as one of the pupils of Santa Cruz Tlatelolco, and who was on to have a great political career. You can think about Hernando Rivas, who comes from Texcoco, who works very closely with Molina. The work that I've done in terms of this partnership between Hernando Rivas and Alonso Molina suggests that they're the authors of this translation of the Imitation of Christ into Nahuatl, which if you take a second to think about this, is quite spectacular. From the 1520s to the early 1530s, between Gante and Valencia and others, they've gone from basic indoctrination to probably by the 1550s, because some of the terms that are used in this first translation of the Imitation of Christ, which survives as a manuscript that is presented by a leading Franciscan to Juan de Ovando, the president of the Council of the Indies in 1570. So we know that it was produced before 1570, most likely between the 1550s and the 1560s. So by the 1550s, 1560s, the kind of conversations that Rivas and Valeriano, and there's also Pedro de Gante, the teacher at Santa Cruz, not Pedro de Gante, the Flemish Franciscan, who's actually a now intellectual. All these people are actually committed to this project, and they've gone so far that they're beginning to take, works like the Imitation of Christ for people who
I think you should explain the Imitation of Christ. Why that is so different from the basic catechism. Mm-hmm.
So this is the first bestseller after the Bible, in the sense that, of course, the Bible being printed by Gutenberg is the first bestseller and continues to be a first bestseller because, of course, it's very popular, imprints of the Bible. But The Imitation of Christ, which was produced by somebody associated with the Minderbrüder, the Brothers of the Common Life in what is now the Netherlands, Thomas a Kempis, probably in the first quarter of the 14th century, around 1325 or so, he produces this work that tries to present examples drawn from the life of Christ in very plain language, but written, of course, in Latin, because this is the language of later expression in the 14th century, right? So he tries to write this work for people who have no background in theology. So this is a work that very consciously avoids citing a lot of theological authorities or passages from the Bible. It focuses on examples that are drawn directly from thinking about Christ and his lives and sacrifices. So this is a work that is chosen by the Franciscans because by the 16th century, this is known as the Contempto Mundi, contempt for the world. This is a word that there's a lot of different treatises that are published or known under that name. And by the 16th century, like thinking about rejecting the world is something that is associated to Kempis and the people who are part of his sphere in the 14th century, which is usually called in Latin the modern devotion, devotio moderna. So this comes to have kind of a new tint in the sense that it is about embracing Christ and it is about following it in your daily life, but it doesn't have to go through a theologian or a deep study of the Bible for you to understand it. So it's a book for shopkeepers, for merchants, for people who have very limited knowledge. So this is translated into basically every major European language by the second by the end of the 16th century. Very self-conscious, I think, Molina and whoever helped him choose that work decide, well, this is a work we're going to use to translate into Nahuatl so that indigenous people will have access not just to the Bible, but to a work that will really, going back to what Agüero was trying to do, Agüero was trying to sell a version of Zapotec history to Zapotecs and have kind of a mixed response, so to speak. Molina is trying to bring in a work which is very successful, has been tested on the ground for generations in Spain as a reason for embracing Christianity. And this obviously is pitched towards Nahuatl speakers who are wealthy enough to perhaps buy a print of the book or know somebody who knows it, has a print of the book to read it. But the problem, of course, is that this work never gets printed. There is a first attempt. As I mentioned before, this is given to the president of the Council of the Indies. It goes straight into Philip II's library in El Escorial. People forget about this manuscript and its existence. By the end of the 16th century, another Franciscan that I mentioned before quickly, Bautista Viseo, tries to revive this translation project and actually announces in his 1606 sermonary, this work is actually coming. The problem is that it never actually came over the presses, either because of concerns about having this work available in Nahuatl or because of the death of Viseo. We don't really know what stopped that. But just one last thing, because I know you probably have lots of questions. While we're on Bautista Viseo, I want to mention, likewise in this mold of taking, let's say, devotional bestsellers from Europe and trying to adapt them to an Nahuatl contest, Viseo pulls kind of a fast one on the authorities in New Spain by taking what is essentially another bestseller, the Book of Prayer and Meditation, Libro de la Oración y Meditación, by the Dominican Fray Luis de Granada. He takes it and takes some of this work is divided into meditations, daily meditations, nocturnal meditations. He takes a for every day of the week. He takes a set of meditations, I think it's Tuesday through Saturday or so, and translates them into Nahuatl and prints it as if it were his own work, which he calls the Book of Misery, Libro de la Miseria. So again, he's inscribing his work in this kind of devotional literature that is based on rejecting the world, rejecting the pleasures of food, of riches, and trying to claim access to this kind of interior life that is devoted to closer observation of Christian principles. And he uses Granada's work, and again, without attribution, they would never have let him publish an Nahuatl version of Granada had he said, well, this is what we're doing. And whereas Molina and Rivas, they were not hiding what they were doing. Everyone knew that this was coming directly from Kempis. So actually, as I said, Bautista is so successful because this work actually is printed with every permission that he needs. He calls it my firstborn. But again, he does that by hiding artfully what he's about to do, which is to take one of the classics in 16th century devotional literature, a bestseller in Spain, and translate it in part into Nahuatl.
That's amazing. So also in this book are not only many examples of textual analysis and taking text in two different forms side by side, very much the way famously, the Rosetta Stone can be used to discover the meanings of languages. But also you have other kinds of performances and ritual practices, something you call self-catechesis, a performance of rosary plays, songs. Maybe you'd like to briefly, Dr. Tavares, tell us about the other contents of this wonderful volume.
Yeah, no, I'll try to go briefly because this is something that I haven't done. And tell you about how the chapters contribute to our conversation about self-catechesis, indigenous reception, and what we call in this book indigenous Christianities. So I mentioned earlier the work on chapters 2 and 3 about Nahua and Quechua so-called confessions, which of course turn out to be indigenous rituals that are not like confessions in the Christian sense, but are recruited by Christian missionaries to convey the notion of confession into Nahuatl and Quechua. Then we have a very interesting book that has been worked on by Gary Sparks and Frauke Sachse, which is basically a notebook of observations by Dominican, Domingo Vico, who tries to take a lot of teachings from Aquinas' Summa Theologica, which is his greatest work. And they look kind of over his shoulder. He's beginning to adapt that work for Quiche and Quechi Maya speakers. And this is also important because Sparks and his other work has shown very interesting similarities in the language using Quiche Maya to describe creator deities in the Popol Vuh, which is usually thought about as the most important Maya sacred book, and the very words that Biko uses to describe the Christian deity in the late 1540s, early 1550s for Quiche speakers. So it's an important parallel, right? And then we kind of jump into reception, an indigenous agency, thinking about how difficult it is for missionaries to impart teachings to indigenous people, even very compliant ones. Justina Olko has a wonderful chapter where she shows how the story of Judas, of course, the person who betrayed Christ, explodes because of the accumulation of sin in his body in this Nahua version. And she shows how this is actually linked to both early modern versions of the story of Judas, but also this notion of imbalance and transgression that goes back to the notion of Nahua transgression as sin that we were talking about earlier. Then Ben Leeming takes us into the world of Fabian de Aquino, who is a catechist who embraces very, very, very fervently the words of the Franciscan, so much that he actually produces a play about the Antichrist, where the former indigenous ritual specialists are presented in a very negative light. So this is kind of, if you think about, Christian works as ideological propaganda, it's kind of a salvo that is written entirely by a very fervent now a Christian. And then, of course, Quitilla Lee takes us into the world of the world of Tupi Christianity, something that is not very often taught about, and tries to talk precisely about the breakdowns in translation and meaning and intention that happen when the first missionaries tried to talk to the Tupis about Christian deities in the beginning of the 16th century in Brazil. Then we have another section that is about how the meanings are transformed, which begins, of course, with a very important chapter by John Chuchek, where he's actually taking the whole Franciscan project we talked about conversion, and kind of turns it on its head by suggesting that as the Franciscans in Yucatan were trying to collect different words, the Yucatan Maya were having a bit of a laugh at their expense because they actually successfully insert sexual innuendo in some of the references that they give to the Franciscans. So when they talk about sodomy, when they talk about certain sexual practices, which apparently Franciscans are have an unquenchable appetite in terms of getting to know the specifics of it. And of course, it's supposed to be for the confessional, right? So from Čužek's perspective, the Yucatec Maya seem to have the upper hand because they are able to guide them in slightly different directions in terms of that point more at sexual innuendo than to what the Franciscans seem to be interested in. This is something, you know, this notion of transformation is also explored by Claudia Brasada in To Make Christianity Fit. And she takes a very interesting passage that concerns the apparent sacrilegious use of a Christian insignia by a Quechua specialist. And she tries to understand how that scene might actually have been understood from the perspective of Quechua speakers who are familiar not only with Christianity, but with pre-contact Andean religions. And then this comes to an end in that particular section with a chapter by Mark Christensen, who talks about this discourse of the signs that are going to be given for doomsday. From, again, going back to the work of Juan Bautista Viseo, which I mentioned earlier, who you know, focuses on them in his sermonary of 1606 in Nahuatl, and from other texts that he has found, primarily in Yucatec Maya, about these signs that are going to be given, you know, in terms of, you know, weather signs, portents, all these horrible things that are going to happen that are going to clue us in to the fact that the world is ending from a Christian perspective. And he shows how this was assimilated by Viseo on the one hand in Nahuatl and by Yucatec Maya writers on the other. And then finally, we have, I should also mention this, the work of Abelardo de la Cruz, who is a now anthropologist, who's currently about finished with his PhD at SUNY Albany. I've been, you know, of course, I've been happy to assist him in some ways with his work. And he actually tells us, you know, what is going on today in Nahua communities in the Huasteca region, that is close to the Gulf Coast in Mexico, and talks about the recent history of catechism, you know, this kind of early push by catechists that were coming just like the people that I mentioned before, that Ben Liming and Justina Olko talk about the 16th century. They're coming, you know, in some ways very convinced about Christianity in the late 1970s. And they come and try to preach that to their communities, and they realize that people are not going to listen to them. So they have to very self-consciously figure out a way of weave in their own interpretation of Christianity, which they very much believe in, with what is called El Costumbre, which is, of course, a Nahua local religion, which comes, you know, of course, primarily from pre-Columbian ways of thinking about the world, but it also has incorporated Christian thinking and a thinking about, you know, 20th, 21st century world within it. And Abelardo de la Cruz gives us kind of a first row seat, because, of course, he's from one of these communities, from Chicontepec. He tells us what people actually on the ground think about this conversation that has taken place from the late 70s until about the early outs in those communities. And he gives a kind of a more harmonious perspective on this, and, you know, talks about how differences are resolved in harmonious ways, and emphasizes in some ways, you know, this kind of coming together of Nahua Christians and more traditional Nahuas, and how they're able to come to an agreement as to the very different meanings that indigenous Christianities will have in only two communities in Mexico. So it's going kind of to the microcosm again, and then going back to understanding how all this range of examples, and this is the work that I tried to do in the conclusions, gives us a sense of what is important to think in terms of that first spread of global Christianity during the Renaissance. And again, The book, you know, for historians, this is something that is important to say because of the examples that we have and the case studies that we are focusing on. We focus primarily on the 16th and 17th centuries. So this is a kind of Renaissance to post-Renaissance period going on into perhaps Baroque literature, Baroque Christianity towards the end. But it's a particular part of the process. And in the conclusions, I try to weave together all these examples and show how global indigenous Christianities emerge in this period and how they're different in practice by different missionaries who are, of course, in some ways hemmed in by the reception that indigenous actors, indigenous intellectuals, and indigenous believers have given to the kind of arguments they try to present about Christianity in different terrains throughout colonial Latin America.
Well, and maybe I can add two things. One, I'd just like to underscore what you said, Christianities, plural. Mm-hmm. You have that in your conclusion, which I think is an important contribution that you write, vibrant and definitely local Christianities engage in a never-ending dialogue with institutional expressions of Catholicism for half a millennium. And we see in each of these chapters an interpretation based on whatever evidence we can find, often very cleverly looking at it from different angles to make arguments about what was really going on in the hearts and minds of the people on the ground. And the second point I'd like to respond to that you just made was your inclusion of your colleague, Abelardo de la Cruz, who is not just looking at evidence that we find in an archive, but his own lived experience, talking about El Costumbre in the Huasteca region of Veracruz mm-hmm. in the last 50 years. And here I was impressed that that not only did they believe in their pre-Christian gods, but they incorporated the Christian God as a praiseworthy member of the pantheon. But he chose the word that the Christian religion encircles the Nahua religion, which I found striking because it really puts the Nahua religion in the center, and then puts the new religion as sort of a veneer or a coat or a way to interpret the old through the new. You have a bit of this in your own chapter when you're talking about the Zapotecs who resorted to ancestor worship and child sacrifice, who continue to count themselves as Christian through a public performance of faith, at least until the next transgression, you write. I guess my point is, we know that anytime a universal religion goes from one culture to another, it has to change for it to be comprehensible. And I think the most obvious example for us all is, to this very day, Christians bring evergreen trees into their living rooms and decorate them at the winter solstice, like the German pagans mm-hmm. did 1,000 years ago, because that was the way that the German pagans were willing to accept the new faith. The new dispensation is like, yeah, but can we still decorate these Christmas trees? And that was the deal. Do you think this is more of that kind of syncretic give and take? Or is it, as Abelardo de la Cruz says, like, no, the center is the center and the new is the new. Can you make an evaluation like that, or is it different everywhere and for every single practitioner? How should we understand Mexico in the year 2020?
Well, no, I mean, this is the hardest question, right? What is the nature of conversion? Ricard actually, you know, had a good answer to that. He's like, I'm not gonna even guess what Gorfron in the indigenous people's dark minds, that's what he called them. And which, you know, kind of relates to early notions about conversion. I mean, William James, you know, thinking about his work on conversions in the late 19th century, thought it was kind of an enigma, a mystery, right? Because at some point, and this is, of course, what the Franciscans were trying to do with far less tools, perhaps, that the latter missionaries have later on, to get into their subjects' minds, not only to tell them what they had to do, but also to confirm that they were believing things exactly in the ways that they wanted them to believe in. So that's quite a mandate. So I guess to answer that question, again, you know, I'm bouncing this off Ricard because I think it's important for your listeners to have a sense of how we're going in a different direction. Ricard also said, well, the one good thing about, you know, Franciscans in New Spain was that, yes, on the one hand, they didn't let indigenous people carry on their work as priests. So that part was incomplete. You needed, from his perspective, indigenous priests to have this more organic acceptance of Christianity. On the other hand, he does say that unlike Protestants, Catholics leave kind of all the implements for conversion in front of people's reach and then invite them to use them in whichever ways they want. And of course, the result is going to be inspected and there's going to be punishment. If you think about, of course, the campaigns against idolatry in terms of the choices that are made by indigenous people. So I think in the end, what we have, and it's important to kind of to understand what indigenous Christianity means, is to get in some ways beyond this notion that Christianity, I mean, it is true. It seems to be ever an ever so pliable religion in terms of admitting the Natalis Solis Invictus, which is, of course, the Roman celebration for the sun in the winter solstice that somehow, of course, becomes attached to when, you know, actually we celebrate Christ's birth, you know. And we can think, of course, about Christianity as, again, having all these encounters with European paganism, with anything between that and, you know, 19th and 20th century Protestant and evangelical devotions, which are, of course, much more important in Mexico and Latin America than they were, you know, 50 or 60 years ago. So I think, you know, when you think about indigenous Christianities, you're going to talk about a word, and we'd like to use the word hybrid rather than syncretic, because syncretic somehow implies that there's some sort of process at which the what has begun to happen has ended and has produced something. Whereas if you think about constant cycles of hybridity, like what Abelardo highlights, right? It is not that Christianity arrived to Chicontepec in the 1970s, right? Christianity has been arriving to Chicontepec since at least the 1540s, right? And different generations get different results, right? I mean, this is more of an anthropological argument, I guess. If you think you can think about Renato Rosaldo's thinking about how different, you know, generations reconstruct their version of their own culture and society in ways that they see fit. And this is something that, of course, has kind of a cyclical and periodic nature. So you can think about indigenous Christianities as, on the one hand, being a constant reshuffling through different modes of hybridity, right? And the most important thing here is, I think, not to note the syncretic or hybrid notion of what happens, but to really try to understand in terms of agency, in terms of reception, what seems to matter to indigenous Christians on the ground and why at different times, right? So to go beyond, again, thinking about that idea of getting into people's minds, but rather trying to look at how it matters for them to be a particular kind of Christian. That's one first, I think, lesson that could be drawn out of this book and its case studies. The other one is this notion of the archipelago of faith. This is something that I've used in my own work in Invisible Wars, for instance, to think about how religion and ritual practices in Mesoamerica are always local. You know, we have this notion of different Mesoamerican principles, but we have, even, you know, before Christianity came around, this very much Altepetl, Yeche, Ga, and I'm using the kind of Nahuatl, Zapotec, and Yucatec Maya words for a polity or community, base levels of religious order, which is, of course, tied to the political order and tied to the territorial order. And this is going to form this kind of, like I said, an archipelago, a quilt, You can, you know, put another metaphor that you like there, in the sense that, you know, what happens locally interacts in some ways with what's happening at the level of the entire colony or transatlantic exchanges. But it's really important to go back and forth between this kind of local focus and the kind of more regional and even transatlantic foci of a religious practices, because, you know, otherwise we risk kind of writing kind of very generic, very large, very broad histories of Christianity that will not give enough weight, I fear, to all the work that indigenous Christians put into understanding their world from different perspectives, which of course, as Abelardo de la Cruz reminds us, include, but are not centrally regulated by the Christian one.
I think that's a wonderful place to leave it, and an excellent point. And I think we all owe a debt to you and to the other scholars who continue to study these languages. And am I correct that they are vibrant, living languages that are spoken in pockets of Mexico? That if you, there are some places where you can go and to a village where Zapotec is spoken, or
In terms of basically, I mean, all the languages that we work with are, you know, living languages. I mean, definitely what was happening in Amazonia today, Tupi languages are not looking as well as, you know, Quiche or Nahuatl, right? Nahuatl has maybe 1.2, 1.3 million speakers in Mexico, but also in different parts of the United States. Zapotec has about 500,000 speakers. Again, you know, sometimes in Mexico, but also in the United States. The same thing is true of Quiche Maya in terms of having speakers throughout Guatemala, Mexico, and the U.S. just because of migration patterns. And a lot of these languages are becoming more kind of translocal and transnational languages. So they're very much with us. And, you know, we're happy to do something that in some ways contributes to the conversation about, you know, what should be done to continue to support speakers of these languages and to preserve these languages in the 21st century in our global society.
It really is a big contribution and a laudable undertaking. So thank you again for this excellent book and also for your time this morning. And congratulations on this achievement.
Thank you, Christoph.